Good morning. I'm hoping to have a felt board here so I can do some felt board marking and drawing and show you what I'm going to talk about this morning. My name is Bob Brubaker, and I'm an ex-IBMer. I worked for them for 35 years and 9 months, retired in 1992, and got back in the business as a land administrator for another totally separate company, working on a Novell server and 500 user IDs and 200 PCs in a manufacturing environment. So at this point in time, a year ago today, or very close to today, I formally retired from professionally doing computer work. So I've had quite a few years. I hired in IBM in 1956, and I went to field school in Los Angeles, and most of my career, concentrated career, was in Los Angeles, Southern California area, working mostly in the aerospace, large mainframes. So with that as a background, I'd like to proceed on to telling you about the first machine I was trained on, where I worked on them, and a little bit about the box. The IBM 704 system was designed in late 53-54, and it was installed in last 54, start of 55. As far as I know, you may have some data. Some of you people know more about history and things. As far as I know, the 704 was the first commercial machine out there with what we commonly call today index registers. The IBM 701 was its predecessor. It had no index registers. You had to do all your indexing through the main accumulator register. If you wanted to go through an array, you had to save the data in the accumulator, load an index value in the accumulator, subtract one from it, store it into the address of a instruction that's going to now pick up the next pointer in the array or buffer block or whatever. You hand did indexing through little routines. That was labor intensive. The 704 had three index registers, and that let it do quite a bit more than previous machines were able to do. The 701 computer had electrostatic memory originally. It was a predecessor to core memory. And this is a tube from the electrostatic memory. The deflection plates were plates, not magnets, so it was quite fast for that day. And they could deflect to 1024 dot positions. And they made a dot or they made a dash, which represented a 1 or a 0. The way they read it out was a capacitive plate on the front with a single electrode that went out to the grid of a 6CV6, and they had a 3-stage amplifier that amplified that weak little capacitive coupling from the dot or the dash readout. And that's the way you've got ones and zeros. So anyway, this will be over at the Computer Museum Lab. What's that? The Williams tube? Williams tube, and there were 72 of those in the 701. So it had 2,048 words in it. It's a word machine, 701. The 704 again was a word machine, scientific floating point. And its original production, it was a fixed point. It did not have floating point on it. We did put engineering changes to get it up to floating point. And they made a lot of them. The 701, they made, physically they made 18, produced them, put them out in the field, and I forget which aerospace screamed and yelled and cajoled IBM, and they took the engineering model in Poughkeepsie and put it back out in the field. They upgraded it to customer specs because it was an engineering box. They had haywire wires all over it. They got it back up to a production level, they felt, put it out in the field. So there were truly 19 701s out in the field. The 704, with its index registers, I recall working, I recall working on serial number 187. So we made something over that in the amount of processors. They serial numbered them in sequence. So maybe we made 200, I'm not sure. They had made at least 187 704s.
Stack
of
chairs.
Could we do that?
They've got to come apart and all together. Yeah, stack them up.
Oh, I see. Very good. Would be a big one. So much more prepared than the previous instructor, who resulted in smoke, which we love. To start with, on the 704, it had a storage register signed through 1 through 36 bits. It had an accumulator, a little screwy here. It had signed Q bit, P bit, 1 through 36. And over here to the right, we always signified it over the right, it had a multiplier quotient register for multiplying and dividing, signed bit 1 through 36. And off to the side, obviously, is these three new index registers. They weren't 1, 2, and 3. They're A, B, and C. They were, the address was 36-bit, I guess they were 18-bit. I have to think about it now. It's a long time. I can't remember all the details here. But it was the address portion of the word. You had your opcode. You did have a modifier in some of the commands, instructions. And then you had three bits here that would point to one of the index registers. And you'd add that index register value to the address portion.
Is that the only way to get the subroutine back?
Oh, there were special transfer and set index instructions that would load these with the instruction counter. The instruction counter down here, register, always, you know, plus one. Some instructions had a plus two, plus three. We had skip one, skip two instructions, but generally you add one to the instruction counter, and there was instructions that would take the instruction counter plus one and slam it into these index registers in complement format, and you could then use that index register to run back to your main routine. So you could walk to a subroutine very conveniently. That was one of the things they put into this machine, was how to get to a subroutine and back. And the 701 programmer said, it's a mess to go to a subroutine three places in your program. You got to do all this setup in your main program. And this one instruction, there were three or four capable of setting the index register from where you were. Tick's instruction, transfer and set index to the two's complement of where you were, then you could branch back. Cool. Let me give you my presentation, and then I'm going to open it up to questions, fully open any questions you've got. But so write them down, okay? And this machine on its I.O., all I.O., went through the multiplier quotient register as its data path. No data channels at all. All data had to go to and from the I.O. devices. You copy instruction had to copy every single I.O. word. So you had a little copy routine, three or four instructions using index registers. If you wanted to write out a buffer, 50 words, you'd set up an index register and a copy loop, and the copy instruction was unique. It would hang until the I.O. device was ready for the word. Then the copy instruction would go to memory, get the word out of memory, put it in the MQ register, and ship it to the particular selected I.O. device. One I.O. device at a time. And if you're writing tape, you didn't write or read anything else. One device at a time. Because that's the one data flow to and from. Okay. Now, memory, the first machines that came out with 4096 words of memory, one memory frame. You could get a second memory frame. And then eventually we came out with a 738 memory, and it was a 32K word memory frame. More advanced. It was tubes, but it was core memory. This is not the core that it represents, but there's some core memory you can look at later. But this was the sense amp. It was a solid state, 7-transistor sense amp that brought the core flip just up to a level that 0 to 12 volt, 12 U6 could amplify and get it up to a signal level. Signal levels in the machine were 40 volts. Positive one was a plus 10, and a negative logic, a 0, was minus 30, plus 10 to minus 30. 40 volt chip. Old telephone, 48 volt stuff. They wanted, positive switching into the grids of tubes. Well, that's why it was so slow. To do a 40 volt shift, it takes, major portions of microseconds to just shift the voltage at tube circuitry capabilities. Solid state, we know, is, in the nanos and picos. Okay, as I mentioned, all input-output was done through the multiplier quotient register. You could use the accumulator, but it couldn't be any of the opcodes that would ever deal with the MQ. Plus, if you were reading a card through the card reader, ED called the card reader, you would give a select to the card reader, which would pick a clutch in the card reader. That's all it did, and start the card reader moving. Bring up some select flip-flops that would say what's coming in from the card reader, hang on the input from the MQ. And then another little cam-operated contact in the card reader would say 9-row time, and we'd get a pulse in the CPU. And at that instant in time, if you didn't have a copy instruction hung in a machine, waiting to copy the word that's going to get broadbanded into here, you overran the card reader, underran, whatever you want to call it, and you lost that whole card because it gave you a copy check and you're dead. So you had to hang on every word coming in from an IBM card. 9-row left, 9-row right, 72 columns, 8-row left, 8-row right of an IBM card. You had 24 words on an IBM card that you could get in on one IBM card. You didn't use all 80 columns. The last, what is it, 70, 73 through 80, generally you punched up the sequence number. So if you drop the deck, you can put it in an IBM sorter and sort the deck back in order. Front card is typically a loader card. And when the machine started, like you wanted to load something, you'd go to a button on the console called Select Card Reader. Whatever was in memory sat there. No clearing of memory. They had a clear button with clear memory if you wanted to. And you would start the card reader going and read three words in. Nine row left, nine row right, eight row left, and the CPU would be released to execute instruction at memory location zero, which is where nine row left. It better be an opcode that's going to do something. And you had three instructions to create the bootstrap to pull in the rest of the card. There is no post as we know it today, no power on self-test, none whatsoever. The clear button or power on to the whole processor gave a memory clear sequence once, so everything was lost on power on. And if you got a program check or a halt instruction, yes, you could put in a one card loader. And that one card loader could then dump the rest of memory. And they built such a sophisticated deck of cards that was a memory dump program that it would sneak on the machine and only destroy seven of the low memory locations and write all of low memory out to drum, one big out to drum, yep. Only destroy seven memory locations. They overlap instructions on itself. So that was kind of fun to debug that thing when it failed. So that gets us through, you know, the basics. The tape drives, again, we gathered 6-bit bytes, and the multiplier quotient copy instruction would shift these out till a full word was done automatically inside the processor. And when 6 characters had been shipped out to the tape drive, when you're writing 6 characters, then you had to get another copy instruction. And so we only used one portion of the multiplier quotient, 6 bits of it, to ship to the tape bank system. The tape bank system was one bank of drives, one drive at a time, 7-track tape, old BCD 7-track tape, 200 bits to the inch. Now I have a reel of tape here. Where was it? Anybody see it? Did I put it over here? Now, in all IBM presentations, you start with your codon. It's the acceptable thing. But after you get going, then it's acceptable to take your codon. Here's a reel of 701 tape. All the rest we all know on 7-track Mylar tape, pretty strong, tough stuff. This was acetate. It would break, it would fall in the columns, go right in the middle of a large run. And it was very frustrating. And we all were very glad when break off your own little piece and pass it back. We used to develop that tape. The 701, the predecessor to the 704, was 100 bits to the inch, and you could literally 200 and 100 bits per inch take a ground up filings suspended in some kind of a liquid that would evaporate quickly, put it on the tape. The iron filings would go around the little magnetic polarities that had been put on the tape, and with a magnifying glass, you could actually read the characters down the tape. The 7th bit was a check bit. It was odd parity. We could write the tape in even parity for commercial machines that used even parity. But since we were a binary machine, there's a possibility of a word being all zeros, isn't it? With no sign bit on it. So when you wrote the tape and it wasn't binary coded decimal commercial data, it was scientific data, you always wrote in binary mode. You could write in binary mode or decimal on the tape. It's two different commands. Terrible stuff. Broke all the time. Now, the I.O. devices were a drum,
a line printer, an IBM card reader, an IBM card punch, and tape. There was a CRT called the 740. It was output only, and all I ever saw was two pictures of Marilyn Monroe and someone else in an improper position. They put them both up at the same time, and everybody laughed at it. We said, wait a minute, don't do that.
But they did do some graphic output on that CRT, and they had a companion printer from some OEM company that would print graphic output. The keyboard terminal, what was that? We didn't have them. No Silent 700, no ASCII terminals whatsoever on the machine. One man on a machine at a time. When it was your machine, you stick your card in the card reader, hit the load button, and off it chunked. There was a button for load tape. There was a button for load drum. If you put a bootstrap out on drum, it would load. If you put a bootstrap out on a tape, it would load. Thusly, Fortran for the 704 was the first Fortran out, designed partially by IBM, or I don't know who else. This is a Wiley publication, dated really recently. I'm sorry that I don't have something older, 1961. But it tells about some of the first Fortran that was available. That came on tape. You walked up the machine, mounted a tape on tape drive one, pushed the load tape button, and in came the compiler. The first Fortran that came out only would read a source deck of Fortran code from the card reader. And one of the first big requests was, we can use an offline card reader to make a tape and BCD. So the second Fortran that came out, as I recall it, and I was just a customer engineer fixing this beauty, could have a source input tape from a tape drive with your source code on it. It would go through a compile stage, and that was the first time we found out our tape drives didn't work. All diagnostics ran, and Fortran would tell us exactly what's wrong with the tape. It had creep in it. Tapes would creep actually backwards over a load point. It gets kind of techie here, but how do you write on a tape? Well, you can write from load point, record, 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 and write an end of file mark. Technically, it's possible to go after the end of file mark and write record, 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 and a second file out on tape. Absolutely legit, isn't it? On a tape drive. What happens if you go back and want to rewrite the second file? Does it always position itself after the first end of file at the same spot? Some cases it might creep backwards a little bit. That's what happened. A record would creep back into the first end of file marker and overwrite it. Now you couldn't get back where you were. So our tape drives had to be carefully readjusted once we got Fortran on the machine. We didn't know what was happening. Diagnostics all ran, but they didn't test for that sort of mechanical misalignment. Interesting. The computer was all hard tubes, other than this new 738 memory. Before it came out, there was only diodes, tubes, speaking coils, and resistors. The power supply voltages, wow. The plus 150 drew 30 amps, the minus 100 drew 30 amps. It was about 250 millivolts of ripple. 30 amps is not enough to start a car, but it's good to get a current. Then there was a plus
220, what the load resistors on AND gates. There was a minus 250, what the load resistors on OR gates. And there was a plus and minus 15 supply because we clamped voltages. Plus 15 and a minus 30 supply. We clamped the signal voltages. Some tubes would tend to go up to plus 20. They drive the circuit so hard, so we clamped the voltages with clamp circuit diodes from that clamp supply.
We actually supplied current to the clamp power supplies from the logic driving circuits. They actually suck current rather than set the levels. Kind of interesting. There were, in the 704,
five, 6,000 tubes in the whole machine. The machine would take the floor space of this room and that room. And it was powered by bus cable, a little bit bigger than your crutches there, copper bus, three phase, neutral ground. Kilowatts, I don't know. Heating, I don't know. I don't remember those numbers. But it was big. It was a lot of current. I mean, you take quite a bit of AC to cool the machine down. We had preventing maintenance on the machine. Most of the machines, 2 hours every morning, generally 7 to 9, if the customer, you know, if that fits our schedule the best. That's when you did preventing maintenance. And if you didn't do preventing maintenance, your machine was degraded really fast. You margined the voltages quite often, mostly the plus 150 and the minus 100, the main current voltages, you margined them. And if you got those voltages, no, the plus 150 would go to 164 for the easy. It wouldn't get below 142, 143. Get off those voltages, machines start failing. Diagnostic show errors. Minus 100 was still pretty small limits too. No more than plus or minus 10 volts. So,
you know, it was a sensitive machine. It wasn't a machine that was, you know, voltages go all over hell and it still ran. These would be up here for you to peruse and look at.
I do have up here a principles of operation for the 701, 704, the 705 commercial machine, and the 7030 stretch. And I have a real good old manual. I'll describe it to you. I'd rather not you touch it or open it. I'm doing all the touching and what mucking it up. It's a famous article, Scientific American. I'll read it to you. April 1933. Machines That Think, by Dr. Thomas Ross. Anybody know that? And in the article here, he describes a relay circuit with a magnet, a ball, flips over, makes contact, comes back around, and latches the circuit. And his article is, "We Can Make Machines That Think." It's a 1, 2, 3-page article. 1933.
I got this at a garage sale for a nickel. I'm telling you, garage sales come up with some amazing things.
The logic book, I'll open up here and leave it out so you can take a look at it. 20202, we had logic, the customer engineers hated because he had to flip a page open to see the whole logic page. Oh, that's not the page you want. You had to close it, thumb through again. So the new logics on the 704 were all right there on the sheet. They made them bigger, not much bigger. But this is an adder in IBM's vernacular. It was sort of built inverted or opposite to Remington Rand Univac's adder. We used AND gates going to OR gates. They used OR gates going to AND gates, so there was no patent problems there of how you made a one-position binary adder that would generate a sum and a carry to the next position. Ripple carry adder. So I'll leave that out for you to take a look at.
Now, the next machine we have is the 709. It came out in, actually, 1958. And it was the first machine that I know of,
catch me if I'm wrong, that used the cycle steel data channels. It was truly a 704 on the covers, but its I.O. did not go through the multiplier quotient register. It had a data channel on it, and you could write tape, write drum, you could write the card reader, printer, punch, and tell it, select the printer, write from this memory location, I've set up a print buffer, and so many words go out to that device, and give me an interrupt when you're done. I don't want to hear about it anymore. And you can go off and compute all you wanted in the CPU. The first little steps toward overlapped I.O., truly overlapped I.O., wasn't multi-programming, because you didn't have a dynamic address translator box to partition the programs in memory. You didn't have enough memory to even cough at. Still the same main memory, 32K frame with this sense amp in it. It was still tubes, between 8 and 9,000 tubes in it, because it had a data channel. You could have two banks of tape drives, and you could have a write on this bank on one drive and a read on this bank on another drive, all going simultaneously while you're computing in the CPU. Still three index registers in the processor, still the same multiplier, storage register, accumulator, and standard one cycle for memory readout. The memory was still 12 microseconds readout regen, core memory. And so it took, well, other than the no-op, it took 24 microseconds for the average load accumulator, store accumulator, add to the accumulator, load accumulators. When you got to multiplies and divide, there were sub-cycles, obviously, for multiply and divides for the 709. What's that? The same. 709 still had three.
No, I meant into that instructional execution
time. No, never did. And in 704 also, or 709 did not add to the instruction execution time. They figured out how they could, in instruction fetch time, overlap it into the execution time. They didn't conceive of that in the 701. Its machine cycle was 12 microseconds. They did only instruction fetch during I time. During E time, execution time, they did only data fetch, and they completely solved the ripple carry adder in the accumulator in that 12 microseconds for the execution of the of say an add to the accumulator. And at the end of that cycle, there was you started all fresh new with another instruction. You weren't doing some of the on execution. I'm going to draw a timeline here. If you have an I time here of 12 microseconds, instruction fetch, go fetch an instruction, and you have an E time, execute that instruction down here, you can finish off the execution in the next front part of the I time, because the I time's got to take the memory address, put it on the bus, go to memory and tell memory start memory. Well, that takes up a good portion of the front end of ITIME. So why don't you finish off the execution of the add? You still have the opcode sitting there and you haven't thrown it away yet from the previous add or whatever the instruction is. So you can do a lot of the execution on the front end of the next ITIME. So 704 and 709, they got a little smarter in that execution. I do have a code card for the 701. What did we count up the other days? 20, 35 or 36 CPU opcodes for the 701, no data channels, no index registers. Even an 8080 had a lot more opcodes than that. That's this guy right here, 36 instructions. The 704 had a whole bunch more opcodes on it. And it had floating point opcodes. When most of our customers got the floating point engineering change, so they got floating point arithmetic, and that was implemented on the 704, and everybody got it factory installed on the 709. It just came with floating point. If you're going to do wing stress analysis and, you know, scientific type computations, you wanted floating point. What did the 704 and 709 not have? Didn't have disk, as we know it today, no random access disk. It didn't have terminals, ASCII, AS400, Silent 700 terminals with ASCII in, printed output, and the most rudimentary, it had none of that on it. What else? So no scanners. Telecommunications, none. What else? What else that you might have?
About 6 feet off the ground. Through the library,
Now, this is 120 print positions, but you could do suppressed print, so you could set up.
Yeah, but I mean the number of characters that you could print.
Wide?
No, the number of symbols.
Oh, symbols, BCD.
Yeah, but they used.
Binary coded decimals. Upper and lower case, but that was it.
Sometimes 48, sometimes 64.
Yeah. Right. Okay, what other I.O. that you're familiar with today?
Audio.
What?
Audio.
Oh, you know audio.
You can shoot an AMT.
No. What else? What other kind of I.O. is there today? CRTs, keyboards, what? None of that. Network, no telecommunications. One machine. When it's your machine, you walked up, decked it with carburetors, ran the job, and you sat there till your job ran. You didn't have to, but you know, it's 2 minutes, 3 minutes, a 12-minute job. You may as well sit there, take your output off the printer. You own the machine. If the program halted, you know, the name of the day was next man on the machine. Get your memory dump, get your core dump. There's where term came from, core dump. Get your core dump, walk off, and it printed on the printer quite a while for your core dump. Take that over to your desk and figure out what went wrong.
It's amazing the analysts can sit there and read
there you go. There's a man who knows.
Okay.
It was an octal machine. The 36-bit word, we got used to reading it out in octal. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10, 11, 12, 13. We read it out in octal on the keys, and there were little ticking marks on the accumulator, little tiny longer lines on the accumulator that would put it in 3-bit groups. So you could read it real easy as an octal digit. What other kind of I.O. do you have today? Come on, you guys got all got PCs, you got whatever. No graphics. Operating system. North American Rockwell built a 200-word rudimentary operating system, which did very little other than load the device you want and rolled itself back in after the end of a Fortran job into memory off of drum. Pulled itself in, put it in drum, and it stopped at its normal stop. And then they used sense switches on the console. What job are you going to run next? And they had several sense switches that would kick it in to load from the device that needed to be loaded from for the next job, in the card reader. So the operator didn't have to hit the load button very much. He just played with sense switches and hit the start button. But memory wasn't cleared, and if you had poor programming practices in your job, and you just picked up a buffer and accidentally used the data rather than load the data in the buffer first before you computed on it, your job didn't run the first time. We'd get called out from the CD room, hey, my job didn't run again. You'd go out and run. Okay, did you clear the memory? Well, I don't think it happened. Well, let's clear the memory, load the operator, you know, their full operating system, and it ran. We'd walk off and shrug our shoulders. It wasn't the machine. It wasn't the stuff.
you never took the time to find out. So you got the feeling of,
yeah, I got two failures yesterday. I had to call me out of it. You know, I got an intermittent machine. To this day, I don't know. It's only when you could repeat the failure and got a pattern enough on it, could you say, I think I'm getting memory errors. I think I'm getting tape drive 3 errors. The diagnostics were very rudimentary. Early on in the game, I loved diagnostic programming. I spent a great deal of time writing little one-card programs, multi-card programs, to do all kinds of testing on the machine. Over in memory, on the 709, there were many more instructions on the 709 for its new channel I.O., but they also put in a zero test instruction. Test memory for Ulzer. What did they use? Very simple, they used the zero test matrix on the CE1 and zeros panel over on memory. There was a big matrix there in the memory frame that you could flip test ones, test zeros, you could write ones, write zeros, flip it in tests, and if they ever picked a bit and you had loaded it all with ones, it would stop. You'd see the memory address and you'd see the bit and the word that picked up. They used that matrix for that instruction. We didn't know that to begin with. And it took us a while to figure out, oh, it's that diode matrix over there. It's the ones and zeros diode matrix, and we got to fix that to get that instruction. We figured it'd be over in the CPU. Interesting troubles. Okay, at this point, I'd like to open it up to any questions you have that are technical about the machine. I'm not a politician, and I probably won't do well on why did IBM do so-and-so type questions, but try it.
What kind of stuff were you doing for that 2 hours of preventative maintenance?
Mostly tape drives and mostly margining voltages.
Adjusting some variable resistor?
Oh, we had a big console that would take any one of the power supplies, and they had a sensitive regulator on it that would ding power down if it went out of a certain range. We invalidate that. The little switch, we can invalidate that. We could margin them plus 150 up to 180 and, you know, down to 110 if we wanted to. We never took that range. We'd take that little sensitive circuit out because that would gain power down. If your voltages went out of regulation, power dropped from the machine all the way. And we'd trip that out for that supply and then run a kind of a variac, a little pot that went back to power supplies. And we'd margin voltages. Run the diagnostics and pick the troubles off. Scope them. Easter egg them. Some guys were great at Easter egg. No one here?
I was basically going to ask that same question. So you would run it at a high voltage or a low voltage and find the diagnostic failed and then determine if the tube was weak or what would you
right.
do?
Well, the diagnostics would generally print out, if we didn't take it to rock or fault failure, it would just start printing out. Many of the diagnostics would tell you routine, the page, the memory location, the code of the diagnostic. We'd look that up, and there'd be this little routine. Testing all accumulators for once, and we'd look at the little change, little 5 or 6 or 10 step routine. They'd load the accumulator bottom position with the 1. Then they'd subtract from it the 1. And then they'd test it for being all zeros, or something like that. And then they'd ripple, they'd shift, use a shift instruction. Load the accumulator with a 1 and bit 35, shift it left, shift it back, and then compare it to the memory location that had a constant in of a 1. And they go, dump, dump, compare it, dump, 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 shift it back, compare it. Accumulator position 15 will not hold a bit. So now you're down to get the logic diagrams out, either Easter egg it by going to that column unit that had all the accumulator, multiplier quotient, and storage register in it. One card here would have all this in it. And you just said, okay, I'll just put all the tubes in. That was Easter egging. And there were guys that had their coat pockets, their old little tubes. They loved that.
The diagnostic
coding has been
the satisfying program in the business.
Oh, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And then as a result, if it was, hey, that didn't work, you say, ooh, you know, got something else wrong.
It could be some IO thing that was hanging that line up, coming into the accumulator, always having a hot dip. And so now you had to get the scope out, get the logics out, get on the accumulator, go back to all the variable inputs on the accumulator, which would be storage, the adder, the multiplier quotient. Depending on where it was, you had the index registers that could gate into the bottom of the accumulator. And in some cases, the instruction counter, storage register, the US register, could gate into the accumulator. So you had to look at all those inputs. Maybe you'd find a hot one coming up. You go back on that, and now you'd find your real trouble. Yes?
See, you had to know more about that machine than you could design. The design team, an engineer would get a piece to design. Not design the computer, design the equipment, design the IO machine. And then the CE had to know all of it. So it was easy to call a factory, get the guy that designed out of the circuit. You're probably a stupid idiot. Why didn't you know this? But you had to know the whole bloody thing.
I thank you for that compliment. That's true. Some of us had to really know the guts of it.
You had to go find their errors too.
We were, as the saying goes, component circuit junkies. This was pluggable. It cammed in. It's got a little camming surface here on this pluggable unit. It had a tool that would cam it down. There are pins here that went into its mating socket. And you never married it or unmarried it with DC power on. That was just a cardinal rule. So you had to drop DC power, which killed everything. Take it out. You had no spares. You had to find the diode on the AND gate. And I don't know whether you can see it here. I'll pass it around. There's a diode open. I shot the bug on that one, hanging out. It was against its pin, but never solder flowed. But it was tight against it when I found it. Now it's out in the open air, embedded. And it was a leg on an AND gate, so it caused an intermittent and soldered it just sitting there. That was a pretty good bug. Whoops. Some of the drum circuits out of the drum are very difficult to shoot. Minimal circuitry. The machine had no internal checking at all. Internal. There was only the seventh bit on tape parity checking, and that parity checking was done by the control unit. Control unit checked parity and would report, I've got a tape check. Parity. Yes?
How was the drum, was the configuration of drums, or one long spiral track?
Interesting. Drum was on a steel drum, but then they wrapped what's called cunafi, copper, nickel, whatever, wire around it, real tight. I mean, just as tight as they could get it to each other, each piece, all the way around, in a spiral. Then they put it on a lathe and trimmed off down at the 50% point so they had smooth copper, nickel, cunafi wire. That made it smooth, and it was right at the 50% level, so two rounds it was actually die smooth. So there was the copper nickel magnetic material, and then the heads were mounted on a mandrel outside the drum, and we screwed them in. We literally had a scope on them, and we'd screw them in looking at the signal on the scope until you actually zinged the disc and backed it off like an eighth of a turn. You'd actually fit the head on the disc, zing it in, bring it back, and you set it and you never touched it.
Worked on a drum and had a head that adjusted the eccentrics. Every time in class or something, they said, can you turn that power on? And the instructor would say, yep, it's got to be good.
So that was the drum. We had 8K of 36-bit words on a drum frame. You can get two drum frames. You can get 16K of drum. Next question.
Was the 7.4 actually designed to use floating point? Or was this something that somebody realized in the production and that came to get it?
It wasn't designed to use floating point. It was a total add-on layer. It was a major field engineering tool. Major. The machine was down for
5 days, 4 or 5 days, so we did back panels, yellow wiring, all soldered, no wrap in it at all. And it was, they gave us these pluggable units, where is it, back there, and the back panel had to have the yellow wire on it. The pluggable units were finished. We didn't have to be wiring them pluggable units. We had to pull a lot of pluggable units out, put all new ones in. But then the back panel wiring, we had to wire by hand, right out in the field. And we started, yes.
So when they sent me the back panel units, have they tested them to back and verified them?
Well, the pluggable units have been tested at the factory, but the back panel, the frame, you need to come up and look at what the frame was like. It was an L-shaped frame. You could actually close the L-shape and make it real thick. But when it's swung open, there were three, what we call frames, mainframe one, mainframe two, mainframe three, mainframe four. And mainframe five was a little box, two big puffy tubes and a little tube, and a 1 megahertz quartz crystal oscillator. We could margin the frequency. Take a V10 out, turn a knob, big tuning condenser like an AM radio, and contort the 1 megahertz fast and slow. And that was effective sometimes in finding troubles. Yes. Questions?
I think that's, we have to wrap it up now.
Okie doke. That's a wrap. Talk to me later.